Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is Wednesday, March 1st. Today we have Tavi Costa. Tavi is portfolio manager at Crescat Capital. He's been with the firm since 2013, responsible for developing Crescat's macro models as part of the thematic investment process there at Crescat. His research has been featured in financial publications such as Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Yahoo Finance, Real Vision, and others. He's a native of Sao Paulo, Brazil, and fluent in Portuguese, Spanish, and English. Before joining Crescat, he worked with the underwriting of financial products and international business at Bray Service, a large logistics company in Brazil. Welcome, Tavi.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this conversation.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your macro, global macro view on like the global economy and financial markets in general.
Yeah, I think it starts from research that we've done recently regarding questions that I think are more important than answers when you're an investor, and especially it starts with the potential for a period of a long-term period where we may see inflationary forces and especially inflation rates higher than average, along with cost of capital being higher than average as well. I look back throughout history, there are really five other decades where we had a very negative performance, or I should say a negative performance, but all of them were in fact deeply negative returns in real terms. Those are the 1910s, the 1930s, the 1940s, and also the 1970s, the 2000s. And my question is if we're going to have another one of those. It is interesting to me that when you look at those prior decades that we had deeply negative returns, all of those happened during inflationary eras or during periods when valuations of risky assets were very elevated. And I think we have both problems today, which is something that we haven't seen throughout history. The two imbalances are, in my view, one way that have conditioned investors to be really valuing assets as if we're going to see another long-term period of low cost of capital in a disinflationary environment. That's not my view. And so if you extrapolate from that, clearly, I believe the markets are pricing assets in a very incorrect way. And just to use it as an example, if you look back during inflationary eras, the 1910s, the 1940s, and the 1970s, the CAPE ratio, which is the cyclically adjusted PE ratio for equity markets in the US, were somewhere close to, call it 15 times. Today, we're at 29 times. We're starting the decade at the same at those levels. At the end of the decade of those inflationary eras, the CAPE ratio actually compressed significantly and got to single digit numbers. And I think it begs the question, what if we have a period where CAPE ratio at the end of this next 10 years would be at single digits? What would it take to the S&P 500 to be reflecting those multiples? And it would be a very drastic decline in prices. We're talking over 50% decline. And while I think that that may sound too dramatic and perhaps too extreme, I do think it's very possible because we've been, again, we've been conditioned to in the last two decades or so to think that we should be investing in a high growth and low cost of capital environment when I think it's going to be probably the next 10 years will probably be negative real growth or stagnant growth at best in terms of real terms. And on top of cost of capital would likely be significantly higher than the average that we've seen historically. And so if that's the case, there's going to be a lot of adjustments in risky assets. And we know that that's the case today in terms of frothy valuations on top of corporate bonds also yielding less than Fed funds rate is the lowest yield spread that we've seen in 30 years. You look at the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000, which is a broader version of equity markets in the US, the yield, the current yield and earnings yield is lower than what you find in Fed funds rate. So the premium that you're taking for the risk is basically not, it's a negative right now. So the risk premium is actually negative in terms of what is being offered to be investing relative to cash. And so it's just hard to believe that we're not going to see some more damaging issues. And you know, the inflation view is a huge part of this thesis. And you know, we have secular drivers today, which we can comment on that, that will create a lot of opportunities in other parts of the market. So you got the 60-40 portfolios failing, folks looking for different forms of investing, which should create opportunities in tangible assets. During times that we've had situations similar to we have today, commodities did very well. We know commodities have been still really underallocated by most institutions. And so you put that all together and you see a commodities to equity ratio today, you know, a 50 plus year low starting to move higher, which seems to me the very beginning of an upward trend with the growth investments being transitioning into value investments for most allocators. So, you know, those are going to unleash a lot of opportunities, and it's going to be emerging markets, specifically commodity-led economies, and so forth. So sorry for the long answer, but that's really where my mind is when it comes to where the macro environment is currently.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great insight and perspective. And more specifically, I know you've been big on energy analysis recently. Can you elaborate on that? I think you mentioned there was some really good free cash flow charts that you were able to share.
Yeah. So basically, we've had a 2 years of energy performances very strong in terms of equities and also some commodities in the energy space. Natural gas is probably one that hasn't done as well, but others like oil certainly are at levels that are very attractive for most of the producing assets that we have, especially in the US, with great margins. And the companies became, in a way, uninvestable by most capital allocators back in 2020 when oil prices were negative. And we've had a change in leadership, politically speaking, in the US, with the Democratic Party taking over the power in the U.S. And that was a time when ESG mandates and policies became even more pronounced. And it was very usual to see capital allocators saying they wouldn't invest in energy companies. But guess what? That was the beginning of upward trend. So I see this very similar way in most of the mining stocks currently. But energy is a very interesting, you know, has a different cycle. Usually the cycle tends to last between, you know, call it 5 years or so would be the average. This could be a longer cycle just because we've had prices moving higher. But when you look at the capital spending cycle for most of those companies, we haven't seen the large increase in capital spending at all. In fact, if you look at the overall industry, I would say that the CapEx in aggregate is still about 67% lower than its prior peak. And that is GDP adjusted, because $10 million spent in the ground today certainly isn't the same as it used to be back in 08. The cost of things have increased and material cost is also a lot higher. So your effectiveness of what you use your capital has certainly changed over time. And so things are moving in towards a direction where the cycle for energy could last a lot longer than 5 years. And when you look at the way those companies are being valued currently, the terminal rate or the terminal value of those assets currently are being seen as they would last for another, call it 7 to 5 years, in terms of their businesses are probably not going to be running operationally as hot as they have been recently in the next 5 to 7 years. And I completely disagree with that opinion in the markets. And you're basically finding a lot of opportunities in terms of free cash flow yield, double digits, with companies that are continuing to be aggressive in terms of CapEx and reinvesting in new projects that I think are going to be great opportunities. Now, overall, those companies are somewhat attracting investors by value approach of doing a lot of buybacks and dividends, which are currently higher in aggregate than when you look at how much they've been spending in terms of capital of CapEx. And that is one other way to see it. However, when you look deeper into the energy space and mining companies too, one thing that not a lot of people have been focusing on is we backtested recently what were have been the best performing stocks in the space. And certainly what we found is that the companies that are actually not paying dividends and not doing buybacks and not returning capital to shareholders have been doing way better, significantly better than the ones that have been. In other words, companies that are being aggressive, spending money on new projects, increasing production, are being rewarded rather than the ones that are not doing that and are actually returning capital to shareholders because they've been basically swimming in cash. They're very profitable businesses. In fact, it's crazy to me that Microsoft by itself, the one company is worth more than the entire sector of energy in the S&P 500. And despite the fact that ExxonMobil by itself makes more money in a free cash flow basis or the same amount of money than Microsoft. And so it's mind-boggling how, you know, markets are seeing all this. And I think there's still a lot of opportunities in the energy space as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's the best for investment opportunities in the producers or like in oil servicing companies like, you know, Schlumberger or Baker Hughes that are making up for the lack of investment, you know, currently?
Well, first of all, I think the overall industry will do very well. So I don't think you need to be, it's nice to be selective and try to create alpha when you're expressing your views in the markets. I think that the best opportunity I find currently is sort of the mid-cap producers. Mm-hmm. It's certainly where our focus has been recently. Those are companies that do have great acreage. So we've been very focused on the quality of their assets, that has been one of the, we hire a geologist to help us. She's got over 30 years working with Shell and certainly has a lot of knowledge in terms of the quality of acreage that we should be investing. And that has been our focus. And so making sure that they have room for production growth and room for increasing those reserves over time, making sure they have reserves that have a life that is in line with our investment thesis. And so certainly that has been most of our focus. But I think you can make money even on the companies that are paying dividends. You know, if you're comparing today energy stocks, even the mega cap paying a lot of dividend and doing a lot of buybacks, I'd rather own that than own a bunch of technology companies that will continue to be extremely expensive and continue to be in a place where most investors that back those companies are still stuck in that view that we're going to see another 10 years of disinflation. And that is not my view at all. And so, right. You know, I just find it hard to believe that energy stocks won't continue to outperform other parts of the market. And I watch that closely every day that I see almost every week times when energy stocks are up while everything else is down. I believe this is might be even happening on the day we're recording this. And so this has actually been very frequent. And I don't think this is the end of it. This is probably the beginning of that. And it's involved with the 60-40 portfolios. You know, imagine all those companies shifting that from that perspective to now starting to look for other opportunities in commodities. Think about the growth to value transition. Think about the cost of capital. Think about the focus towards profitability and margins, which most of those companies in the energy space actually have great fundamentals. So, you know, clearly there are a lot of changes in terms of how we approach investments. And there's a very significant amount of investors still stuck with the 10-year mentality that we had, the prior 10-year mentality of investing in growth stocks and, you know, and not profitable business today.
And in terms of energy, does jurisdiction matter? Like if we look at oil and gas in North America or Europe or even South America, like what are your thoughts on Petrobras or Ecopetrol, some of the state-run, you know, YPF in Argentina versus private-based, any distinction there or thoughts?
We own Petrobras and we own a lot of assets now in Brazil. I shouldn't say a lot, but it's a position in our portfolio. I think it's an early trend in terms of Brazilian assets, in terms of state-owned companies. Mm-hmm. We avoid them, but I think Petrobras actually has one of the highest quality assets in the space, and therefore why we own it. We also know that it's a little more or significantly more inefficient than other businesses that are run privately, but it still is an attractive company, especially when you think about the margin of safety of using a value investor hat in terms of their assets. Is something that continues to be, in our opinion, very attractive. It's hard to believe it won't perform very well over the next 5 to 10 years if we're going to see a trend towards commodities that may favor a lot of natural resource businesses. In fact, that whole industry or the whole sector of the economy, the global economy, so small today that for investors to really allocate capital in that space in a more diversified manner, it will at some point attract them towards commodity-led economies. And Brazil is going to be probably one of the leading parts in terms of that optionality for most of those investors. And so I think that it requires certainly a lot of thinking, a lot of analysis to invest in those areas. There are other parts of South America that I think are attractive when it comes to new areas that might become investable for oil purposes, Suriname and some other areas. Mm-hmm. But those are smaller investments in Crescat. We are aware that it's not our center of expertise. I think mining is a much more niche area that we tend to be more in line with the ideas that are likely to be developing over the next 5 to 10 years. But it still is a relevant position in our portfolio. Majority of our companies are in the U.S., I would say, and mm-hmm. Canada, which I think have great opportunities as well. And so we'll continue to invest in those. And there will be a lot of opportunities in renewables as part of the energy space. I mean, energy companies are literally printing money currently. And as they print money, they can also use that towards new developments in renewables and so forth. And so that's another angle that it's not necessarily a focus today, but I think will continue to be larger as we go. And, you know, if you think about how the whole private equity space really funded technology businesses and venture capital businesses funded most of the technology trends that we saw in the early and late 90s all the way to today, I would think that a lot of the oil companies are going to be the access for capital for the renewable energy investments that we may see, which is a little bit of a counter argument to a contrarian argument to a lot of other conventional thoughts that we see out there. But I do think energy companies are going to become that important access for capital for most of those renewable projects.
Yeah, they certainly have the legacy and revenue, right, to help support that development. And so, like, in terms of Brazil, a lot of people have expressed concern of the new recent President Lula administration. Do you have any concerns there, or will things be okay from a fiscal responsibility perspective?
I think that's the bearish case, personally. And there's always going to be a bearish case for every investment you're looking at to allocate capital towards. And I think that what's happening in Brazil is a shift politically that it's not desirable. However, and I'm speaking towards a capitalist agenda, towards what markets may actually appreciate. But it's important to remember that that's not everything in terms of factors to look at when you invest in a region, in a country, or anything else. And there is a major opposition in politically speaking in Brazil. It's not like Lula have the same leadership support that he had back in the early 2000s, when Brazil actually performed very well when he came in the early 2000s. And Brazil was one of the best performing markets in the world for the next decade. I believe that from the beginning to the end, the Brazilian equity market went up 18-fold, which is something that I think a lot of people don't consider today, because the last 10 years, Brazilian equities actually were down since the beginning of the global financial crisis, compared to the S&P that was up about eightfold or sevenfold since those times. And so it's understandable the level of skepticism, given the fact that that part of the market has not performed. But that's precisely why I get so opportunistic in terms of the idea, just because of the timing of a lot of people not allocating time towards that as a potential part of the market that has a lot of inefficiencies. And yes, Lula will have its ups and downs. It will try to take over control more than a lot of people would think. It's not a political environment that is necessarily ideal for investing in Brazil. However, as I said, I do think that different than any other part that we've had over the last 30 years or so, Brazil has had a very significant shift in development towards the right-wing party or right-wing thinking. And that is one of the only, I think I can say that it's the only country in South America that has that division, that separation of thoughts that creates those that polarization, politically speaking, which I think it's something that has been very successful as a model in the U.S., like it or not. It's important to have different thoughts rather than what most places in South America tend to lean towards the left. So usually your opposition is more of a center, politically speaking, party rather than a right wing. And so in Brazil, that polarization, while it may seem very destructive from even a family environment, I mean, my own family has had a lot of issues because of that. But from an investor perspective, I think that is actually very, very positive. And it's hard to believe Lula will gain so much power to do things that other people think in terms of risk side, just given that the opposition force is certainly unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, great perspective. I know Crescat and yourself very bullish, like on the mining sector, for like especially gold and silver mining. So if we look at that, the commodity sector, we talked about oil. What are your thoughts on resource nationalism? Like what's the best way to protect from adverse risks there in terms of potential, nationalization or takeover by government of resources, or preventing exports of agricultural produce, situations like that, scenarios. What's the best way that investors can position for that?
I think nothing better than seeing successful models being run globally to avoid those issues to really spread worldwide. And what I mean by that is it's a dark but realistic scenario that you were proposing. However, the level of inefficiency of a state-owned company, and I say that with almost certainty that tends to happen, is something that we should be concerned. And knowing that the shortage of particularly metals and mining for the next years, if we're going to see a green revolution and a reindustrialization of most of the developed economies, it's hard to believe that there's not going to be a real push towards a capitalist agenda to really be able to develop those over time. If we're not going to see that, that would change completely the environment in terms of the risk for inflation running much higher for much longer and so forth. But it's not my base scenario. My base scenario is basically we're going to see a lot of investors chasing opportunities in the metals and mining space. I think it's going to be just like oil will become more and more a profitable part of the market. As they become a more profitable part of the market, they will reinvest that in new projects. And so to me, it's been very clear that you can divide the metals and mining into two parts. There is precious metals and there is the battery metals. And it's not like they don't transition, they cannot transact in similar situations, meaning there are companies that run both types of projects. But what's happening today is that we know that difficulty of finding some of the metals in terms of finding projects that are economically viable in the battery metal side. But the biggest issue is that most of the precious metals companies now are seeing the need and a lot of institutional money chasing battery metals. Therefore, they've been transitioning away from precious metals. If you look at most of the major companies, their production for gold has been in a secular decline, which is partially has to do with this green agenda. But perversely, this should be very positive for most of the gold and silver companies, because we know that throughout history, the two times we had gold, massive gold bull markets, which was in the 70s and the early 2000s, and I'm referring to in the last 50 years, was really happened on the back of a multi-year decline in production for gold. And also happened, especially in the early '70s, at a time when gold was a much larger percentage of the international reserves in terms of central banks' assets than it is currently. Today, we're talking gold is only less than 20% of what central banks hold. And it's what we're likely to see is that rather than seeing that treasury ownership or other sovereign debt instruments as part of the ownership, we may see a big shift towards a neutral but also higher quality asset like gold that has a credible history of performing as a central bank asset as well and an inflation hedge. And so over time, I know this is very difficult because a lot of people would say, why would you say this is an inflation hedge if it hasn't worked in the last 2 to 3 years when we actually had inflation? It's just too early to make that call. There's probably going to be a decade of inflation running higher than the prior 10 to 20 years. And as you see investors allocating capital towards that, all we've seen so far has been a duration adjustment where interest rates have been going higher, not only in the short end, but in the back end. And that has somewhat hurt gold in the middle of that transition. Now, did I think that would happen? Well, I didn't think necessarily gold would be as punished as it has been, but it's also a generational thinking of looking for other investments in the crypto space and so forth. And now where crypto is, which is kind of holding hands with most of the growth investments in terms of being being repriced at a very different level, I think that we're going to start seeing a reemergence of gold as a high quality asset, not only for central banks, but also for the 60/40 portfolios and for others. And so to me, this is going to be an important theme. And so it's not only precious metals, but also the battery metals will attract a lot of demand. And for us, the focus towards exploration will continue to be the best part of it as far as the next few years, just because the inefficiencies there are much larger than the producing assets, because there's a much easier form of analyzing those assets than analyzing things that require a geological knowledge in order to navigate that part of the market. So that has been really our focus more recently.
That's an interesting analysis, yeah. And what are your thoughts on China and Asia in terms of, in particular, China investability issue? Is it investable? What are your thoughts on Chinese equities, like, you know, listed on the Hong Kong stock market and other like Southeast Asian countries?
Well, I think there's going to be a separation of this whole notion of what BRICS or emerging markets are. Emerging markets have always been seen as a block of countries where they're all basically the same. They're all always high-paced growth economies. And a lot of those places have been emerging markets forever, like Brazil. It's always been an emerging market, never emerged to be a developed economy. And since the 90s, really, Brazil has been an emerging market. But the point being that what is happening currently is you have a separation of how economies are run inside of this emerging markets category. You can see places like China, which are commodity importers. They don't have a lot of natural resources relative to other parts of the world. I think that would be a problem over time. I think that you don't want to be investing in places that are commodity importers. You want to be investing in places that have natural resources exposure. So a lot of places in Asia, especially China, let's say even Japan, are probably not going to be really great places to be investing. I could be wrong about this, but I don't think you're going to be investing not only in a communist leadership, but also on top of it, you have a place that doesn't have the upper hand on commodity prices. And I understand a lot of people think that China is extremely smart for having large reserves of natural resources. And they do that because they don't have an option and not because this is a long-term sustainable plan towards what is likely to happen in the macro environment. Then you have Russia. Let's say Russia is certainly a place that has a lot of natural resources. It's got abundance of energy and even mining as well. However, it's not geopolitically neutral. I would say that within this realm of emerging markets, Brazil has not only exposure to agricultural commodities, energy, mining, everything looks very attractive from that camp, but also geopolitically speaking, doesn't matter if it's Bolsonaro or Lula, both of them actually ran the country or have been running the country in a very neutral way, geopolitically speaking. It's almost like Switzerland. They sell it to Russia, they sell it to China, but they also have big businesses with North America in places like US and Canada. So it's just hard to believe we're not going to continue to see that. And on top of it, I think that if you look at historically, you do see a very high correlation between commodity producers globally and Brazilian equities. So when you see that correlation, it's very attractive from many other sectors that may actually have a domino effect from that front. India is another place that also is a commodity importer that I think has been a crowded view for most investors as a potential for being this new economy that may actually become a bigger part of the global economy. I just want to say there's a difference between becoming a larger pie of the global economy and actually being a good investment in terms of putting capital into their equity markets and so forth. I mean, Chinese equity market has done nothing over the last 10 years. If anything, it went lower in prices. But if you looked at the participation of China over the global economy has increased over time. Just because of a factor of population and just the size of the economy has continued to grow relative to other parts of the economy that are more, I would say, have already seen that growth, especially in the U.S. and other parts of the economy. But that's the way I'm seeing this. I think there's going to be opportunities in FX markets. You look at Brazilian rates or Brazilian real relative to the CNY, the Chinese yuan, or even Brazilian real versus the Japanese yen. You look at those charts, those trends over 20 to 30 years, they look like, you know, we're going to see a base where Brazilian equities and Brazilian FX may actually start to outperform those developed or emerging markets that are commodity importers. Very simplistically speaking, I think commodity exporters will perform better than commodity importers. It's just, you know, and you can put another complexity to your view on China, which has to do with the real estate bubble that is still carry over in that place, along with the banking credit issues that we see in terms of the size of the banking assets relative to the size of the economy is something we haven't seen in the past, Hong Kong being another one that is part of that. And so to me, it's China is much closer to an implosion economically than to become this sort of reemerging place to invest, like a lot of people like to say most of the times.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Any thoughts on the U.S. dollar, like 6 to 12 months out?
I think my thoughts are more on the bearish side than the bullish. Although I don't share a lot of the views that the dollar would be replaced as quickly as a lot of people think. I don't think there's a lot of options in terms of currencies that could become, have a reserve status, like a lot of people think. I do think gold backed currencies may become a thing again, like it was back in the days, in order to restore credibility of the currencies. I think that we've had been losing that over time. And now that we're seeing a crisis in most bond markets, it's a crisis of central bank assets that a lot of people are not seeing it that way. In other words, is if central banks, the way they increase credibility of their own currencies is to own high quality assets. In the last 20 to 30 years, the most credible central bank assets are the ones that hold a lot of U.S. treasuries. I just don't think that's going to be the thinking in 10 years from now. I think we're going to look back and say, wow, this was very obvious that a lot of central banks would start accumulating gold and other assets in order to improve the quality of their international reserves. I think that would be a trend as well. And that usually is such a large pool of capital chasing assets that are high quality that it's just hard to believe it's not going to create a bull market for the metal. So, and that will have ramifications because if you have gold prices moving higher, then you have silver going 3x that amount. And so, you know, there are high beta versions of gold out there that could perform very well in that environment.
Interesting. And just a final question. The China started the Belt and Road Initiative, and there's a sort of collection of countries known as part of the Belt and Road Forum of countries. And then we have the World Economic Forum of countries. Do you see a division happening over time? I mean, with some countries initially sort of part of both, but drifting to one side or the other between Belt and Forum countries versus World Economic Forum countries?
I don't think basically, well, China has had an upper hand recently in a lot of those projects, and therefore a lot of those countries were end up making deals with China in a way that perhaps in a more challenging scenario, which I think we're going to reach here, they wouldn't be making those deals. And so I think that the biggest ship there is that China is going to have to be softening it up their own, negotiation with those countries over time. And so we're probably going to see a lot of shifts in terms of the projects that have been backed by different countries through those initiatives that you were referring to. I don't have a lot of views of what it's going to be the shift towards, but I do think that, recently we've had this overwhelming opinion that China has the upper hand on a lot of things, not only commodity prices, not only the inflation problems, not only about the labor situation where most economies are still relying on China. That is going to be an important shift that will hurt the Chinese economy too. And so China is going to lose that upper hand. If ever had one, it will certainly lose that upper hand going forward. And that will have a significant impact on how we negotiate things over time. And it's I think that's going to be a big shift on a lot of those frontier markets you're referring to, because they've had terrible negotiations over the years, especially South America too. South American influence of a lot of the Chinese capital into South America has been tremendous, mm-hmm. particularly in Brazil, Bolivia, Colombia, Argentina, and so forth. And I'm not sure that's going to be as large as a lot of people think, as they realize that they can actually make great agreements and great partnerships with other parts of the world that don't require the same level of, in the last 20 years or so, we've only seen one place that is that's been thinking ahead about this scarcity of natural resources, and that's China. And that's just because China looks at themselves and say, well, we don't have any abundance of natural resources, so we have to chase that source somewhere else. And I think that that's going to be a big change geopolitically speaking. And I'm not sure yet what's going to be the ramifications of investments, but I can't think that would be negative for a place like Brazil as they find other opportunities with agreements and partnerships with other developed economies that are much easier to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, great insight, perspective, Tavi. How can our listeners, viewers learn more about your work?
They can learn about my work mostly on Twitter, I guess, at Tavi Costa, but also in our website, Crescat.net, is where you can find most of in-depth letters and long researches research pieces that we put out that I think would be helpful for most people that are looking to understand more, maybe just our views about the macro environment.
Great. Thank you so much, Tavi. Thank you.
Take care.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.